From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week on Foreign Dispatch, a looming deadline in China to provide housing for 5 million people still homeless after the May earthquake. And in Beijing, a different challenge: trying to learn enough English to help Olympics visitors lost without translation. From Spain, we'll hear how celebrity matadors have made bullfighting cool again. But we'll start in Sarajevo and reaction there to the arrest of a long-sought war criminal. In the streets of Sarajevo, people celebrated over the news that long-sought war criminal Radovan Karadzic had been caught. During the Bosnian War in the 1990s, the city suffered a brutal siege at the hands of Bosnian Serb militias loyal to Karadzic. But many citizens of Sarajevo are bitter that Karadzic was able to avoid capture for 13 years. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Sarajevo.
Rasim Ljajic, the Serb minister responsible for relations with the War Crimes Tribunal, today showed the world what Radovan Karadzic looks like after 10 years on the run. In the photograph, the wartime leader of the Bosnian Serbs is much thinner, wears glasses, shoulder-length white hair, and sports a white beard. Gone is the leonine mop and the pompous self-assurance, well known to reporters who covered the Bosnian War. He looked more gnome than butcher of the Balkans. Through an interpreter, Rasim Ljajic.
Karadzic used a false identity and false document, used the name Dragan Dabic. We can tell you that he's been freely walking in the city. Even people he rented his flat from didn't know his identity.
Karadzic's disguise was so effective, he could practice alternative medicine at a private clinic in Belgrade and even wrote articles for the magazine Healthy Life under an assumed name. Ljajic was very vague in revealing details about the arrest, saying Karadzic's movements are being analyzed and will be kept secret until Ratko Mladic, the other major wanted war criminal, is also caught.
There was preliminary questioning last night. He decided to remain silent and defend himself like that.
A Serbian judge has ordered Karadzic's extradition to The Hague. He has 3 days to appeal the ruling. It has long been suspected that the Bosnian Serb leader could remain a fugitive for so long only thanks to a strong support network of hardline nationalists and help from the Serb Orthodox Church and protection from high Serbian authorities. His arrest came just after a new government was installed that is keen to end Serbia's international isolation. And that depends on handing over the remaining war crime suspects. Police have been put on high alert in Belgrade, fearing violent demonstrations, but there were only a few dozen hardline nationalist protesters on the streets Monday evening. Today, one man, Haji Andrej Milic, expressed the outrage and anger of many Karadzic loyalists.
Nobody can take him to Hague. Without a civil war, something like this couldn't happen.
Nearby, Karadzic's brother Luka was sitting in a car. He had just spent some time with the jailed Radovan, whom he described in a good mood and in good health. Luka said that, like the late Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic, Karadzic will act as his own lawyer. Perhaps hinting at the future defense strategy, he said Radovan Karadzic may try to implicate Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. negotiator of the Dayton Agreement that ended the Bosnian War in 1995.
He understood that his deal with Holbrooke was not respected.
Luka Karadzic claimed the deal involved his brother stepping down as president of both the Bosnian Serb entity and the Serbian political party in exchange for immunity from the Hague Tribunal. His words echoed what Radovan Karadzic said in an interview with the BBC after the Dayton Agreement was signed.
Why they should arrest me? The Dayton Agreement has legalized and legitimized our fight for freedom and for our own state.
But in The Hague, Karadzic will face a very large number of serious charges: genocide, extermination, murder, and ethnic cleansing. He's accused of ordering the 43-month-long siege of Sarajevo, during which Bosnian Serb troops starved, sniped, and bombarded the city center, and in which thousands of civilians lost their lives. He's also charged with the massacre of Srebrenica, the worst war crimes in Europe after World War II, in which 8,000 Muslim men and boys were slaughtered. The Hague Tribunal has described Radovan Karadzic as the suspected mastermind of scenes from hell written on the darkest pages of human history. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Belgrade.
Chinese officials have set an August 1st deadline to provide housing for earthquake survivors, but it doesn't look likely to meet the challenge. 5 million people were left homeless in the disaster, which left almost 90,000 dead or missing. On a recent trip to Sichuan, NPR's Louisa Lim returned to the devastated village of Hongbai, where barely a single house was left standing.
We're now in Hongbai village, and I last came here 5 days after the earthquake, and it's just extraordinary what a different sight I'm seeing today. I mean, last time we came here, this street that we're walking along now, on either side it was flanked by houses that had fallen down. There were planks everywhere, masonry, cracked walls. It was a complete mess. And now a huge amount of the town has been completely leveled. It's lunchtime here, and the inhabitants of these blue civil affairs department tents are having one of their last communal meals together. In fact, many of them have just been given keys to their new prefabs down the hill. Of course I'm happy, says 59-year-old Mr. Wang. Of course life will be better in a prefab. And the mood is really quite excited. People here seem really very happy to be moving into their prefab houses. And there's almost a sort of festive air about it. So here we are, arriving at the newly built prefabs. They arrive further down the valley at a new prefab settlement. It's made up of lines and lines of identical white temporary rooms with blue roofs. These bare shells will be their homes, probably for the next 3 years. Each family has been assigned one room, about 175 square feet. As he begins sweeping the concrete floor, Mr. Wang, who will live here with his wife, starts thinking about the future. Right now, they're surviving on the government handouts of just over $1 and £2 of rice a day per person. And as he talks, his euphoria fades.
We used to own a little grocery shop, and after the earthquake, we don't have the option anymore. I'm 59 years old. I can no longer work, so I'm basically waiting for the government to help.
At the tent housing the government headquarters, Wen Xiaogui, deputy director of the Hongbai Communist Party political office, reels off the statistics. He says around half of the 7,700 people living in this village will be allocated prefabs. The rest will be given other help. It's not unfair, he says of the process. The villagers made their own choices. For most of the people moving to prefabs, their houses had totally collapsed, so they had nothing left to build temporary homes. So they applied for prefabs. At the top end of the town, I meet 56-year-old Wang Qifa. He says he wasn't offered any choices. He'd have liked to have a prefab, but says those near him have been reserved for office use, and so he's making do. He's busy building himself a new temporary house out of the remains of his old house. Since the earthquake, he's very carefully cleared away the remains of his house and salvaged anything usable. He's even reusing the nails because he says he can't afford to buy new nails.
Well, the prefab houses are not for us common people. They are for official use only. These are for the police, for the government officials. And ask why not? No prefabs. We don't know. Decisions being made from the top.
He says he's been informed that the army is coming tomorrow to help him build a temporary shelter, and he's very grateful to them. His wife is cutting meat for a meal under canvas. They believe they weren't given a choice because of one key bureaucratic hurdle. Mr. Wang was registered as a farmer, not a town resident. Because of that, they believe they haven't been assigned a prefab. Instead, like many other rural residents, they've been given a $290 subsidy for building their own temporary housing, with help from the army. Further down the valley, in the destroyed township of Yinghua, the picture is even more depressing. There are few prefabs to be seen. Almost everyone is in homemade shacks, and no one knows what the future holds. I met one elderly man who didn't want to give his name, sitting by his devastated house beside the road. He said he'd had no help at all. Here, the government in Yinghua hasn't dealt with what happened, he says. They don't care about this village, which has been so badly hit. Throughout the quake zone, there's a real inequality of provision. In some places, workers build new roads through huge, orderly prefab settlements, equipped with picnic tables, cooking facilities, and exercise equipment. In others, the destruction is everywhere, and people are still picking through the rubble 2 months on. Given the magnitude of the task of housing 5 million people, even temporarily, it hardly seems possible any August deadline could be met. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
When the Olympic Games open in Beijing August 8th, the city hopes to be able to give visitors a big English language welcome. Taxi drivers, police officers, and volunteers have struggled through months of English classes, and city officials have cleared the streets of most garbled or unintelligible English language signs. One police officer has even taught himself to say, "Forget about it," in a New York accent. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has the story.
The best way to cheer yourself, up is to cheer someone else.
The best way to cheer yourself up is to cheer someone else up, say the students at the Unity Lake Neighborhood Committee English class. Some of them will be staffing volunteer booths to give visitors directions. If foreign visitors have difficulty making heads or tails of those directions, it's certainly not because the volunteers aren't trying. Some of them only began learning English after retirement.
My name is Yang Jinghyo. My English name is Jason.
The class's star pupil, 75-year-old Jason Yang, is one of the 100,000 volunteers working at the Summer Games. The wiry and bespectacled former engineer started teaching himself English in 2001, the year China won its bid to host the Olympics.
In 2001, I think, when the Olympic Games are coming, more and more foreigners will come to Beijing. Maybe they need help. For example, they ask me the way, how do I get to the Beijing, where's the railway station, and so on. If I can speak English, maybe I can help them.
Yang has explored the city's sporting venues, bars, and restaurants, and then lovingly made his own maps to show visitors where they are.
There are altogether 71 venues of Olympic Games. If you ask me, where can I see the table tennis? I will tell you, the Beijing University.
Yang and other volunteers point out that there's a limit to what the government can do to get Beijing ready for the games, so ordinary citizens have to pitch in. Then again, some Beijing civil servants are going beyond the call of duty to help out. Police officer Liu Wenli, for example, has become a minor celebrity on his beat in Beijing's Coal Hill Park.
In order to be a good server for the Olympic, I can speak 13 foreign languages. Yeah.
Which 13?
To be honest, I can speak English and French. The rest, just some greeting words. Bienvenido a Chin, gracias. The Spanish, dual welcome to the China, taxomike. That's Swedish.
Not half bad for a former electrician who began teaching himself English 20 years ago. He's a two-time Olympic torchbearer, and he regularly dispenses advice to students of the English language. Listen and imitate.
Yeah, just in my home, I just only watch the TV program and sometimes to watch the Hollywood movies on DVDs. And sometimes imitate the New York accent. Hey, what do you want? Forget about it. Do you understand? What's up, man? Put it down. Yeah.
Lost in Beijing during the Olympics? Go check out my man, Officer Liu Wenli, in Coal Hill Park. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, hot matadors make the sport of bullfighting cool again in Spain.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. Just a few years ago in Spain, bullfighting appeared to be on its way out. Many people, especially younger Spaniards, just weren't interested. And it's largely thanks to a new breed of celebrity bullfighters. Jerome Sokolowski reports.
Crowds of young people are gathered outside a stadium in Madrid. Many have waited all night in the ticket line. But it's not a rock concert that's about to begin. It's a bullfight, and a matador named José Tomás is appearing in the city's main bull ring. One of the aficionadas wears a stylish red dress with spaghetti shoulder straps. She has a small designer purse under her arm. The tickets sold out in no time, so Raquel Campoy grows impatient as she haggles with a toothless old man. Do you think I would spend the night sleeping here, she says to the aging scalper, so that someone could charge me 300 euros for a ticket? That's almost $500, which is cheap. Some fans are being asked to pay more than $1,000 for a seat. Bullfighting was supposed to be a thing of the past, and yet this bullring has an atmosphere like a hip nightclub, swarming with what the Spanish insist on calling los beautiful people, models, celebrities, and politicians. Zaida Padrino is 24 years old and lucky. She has season tickets. José Tomás is number one. He's the best. He stands where nobody else stands. He fights like nobody else fights. He has it all, she says. But this star is famously reclusive. José Tomás shuns the media and usually refuses to let his bullfights be televised. But these highlights that were shown on television show him so close to the bull, it's as though he wants to be gored. And he often does get stabbed by the bull's horns. It seems that the sight of his blood, as much as the bull's, is what excites the crowd. But it's not just José Tomás who's causing a sensation. Elle magazine declared another of the small group of celebrity matadors, the handsome Cayetano Rivera Ordóñez, its man of the year. But a majority of Spaniards are still either not interested or, in fact, strongly opposed to bullfighting. One of Spain's most celebrated novelists, Antonio Muñoz Molina, says the resurgence of interest makes him feel ashamed to be a Spaniard. He wrote an op-ed in the country's leading newspaper, El País, recalling how his father made him sit through interminable fights in his youth when Spain was a dictatorship. Who would have thought, Muñoz Molina wrote, that in this new century, something that repulsed us as one of the worst vestiges of our past would be converted in something modern and sophisticated? Is there really anything noble, he continues, about tormenting an animal and finishing him off in a repulsive sequence of clumsy thrusts? Zaida Padrino thinks there is. Of course it suffers, she says, but that's what it's bred for. The fighting bull lives free and has a fantastic life in the 5 years before it goes to the ring, she adds. Some critics say José Tomás has got it all wrong, that bullfighting is all about gracefully evading the bull. But one leading commentator praised him, saying he shows that bullfighting is about the beauty of death. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.